The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Now, we had planned in time-honoured Westminster tradition to stretch out our summer break into September. But now the PM has shuffled his deck, so we felt duty-bound to reshuffle our diaries and bring you a fix of political analysis.
Huge task. It's the biggest privilege of my life. I'm incredibly honoured and very much looking forward to getting on with the job.
Jeremy Hunt there, who's hunted no more but instead elevated to take charge of the health service. It was only one of several surprises in an overhaul that went further than many of us had reckoned on. Joining me to pore over the political tripe that's left on the floor after Dave's own Night of the Long Knives, we have our Westminster correspondent, Juliet Jowett, who comes fresh from the lobby to give us the latest lowdown. Dan Sabah, who's The Guardian's chief media man and also thereby a seasoned specialist on that winner, Jeremy Hunt. And returning from Lib Dem Voice, we welcome Mark Pack, who will be filling us in on how the progressive partner in the coalition is feeling after the PM shuffled so far to the right. That view of Dave's direction of travel has, Juliet, been the consensus view on Fleet Street. But when you think through the chief winners and losers, is that caricature really justified?
I think that the idea that he's steered to the right or turned slightly to the right is correct. I think, as we've tried to make clear, a lurch to the right or any more dramatic description is probably not fair, or at least it's too soon to suggest that. I think the interesting thing is not just the people in the cabinet, which is when this theory emerged, but yesterday, as some of the more junior ministerial posts emerged, there are quite a lot of, particularly from the 2010 intake, which is a very right-wing intake of MPs into the Conservative Party and makes up about half of the parliamentary party at the moment. There are some MPs with what would be quite traditional right-wing, definitely adrift from the Prime Minister's modernisation agenda and some of the policies and attitudes which emerged before and immediately after the election. Some people with far more right-wing views. I think Nick Bowles, the new planning minister, would be one, who's actually apparently a friend of the Prime Minister's. Liz Truss heads up the Free Enterprise Group, which is
cut red tape and all that.
Exactly, yes. And she's been put into education, I think, to work on childcare in particular. Her chief idea, which has gained a lot of popularity in the party and beyond, is to massively deregulate childcare to make it far more affordable and therefore more available. Other names like that who, it's not just that they're right-wing, but they're really unafraid to say so and unabashed about it, and intellectually confident and politically confident people as well.
Intellectually confident, Mark, but intellectually confident of a rather familiar, dare I say, 1980s agenda in some cases. What do you think?
I think there's certainly a lot of truth in that. And if you look at the 2010 Tory intake, I think what Cameron got right was getting in a much more diverse, much more talented set of new MPs than the Tory party had often done in the past. But they weren't his sort of modern, relaxed, veering towards the centre ground conservatism. And therefore, almost inevitably, if you're looking for new talented people in the Conservative Party, you are looking more to the right. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of Liberal Democrats are not overjoyed by any means in terms of what's happened on the Tory side of the reshuffle. On the Liberal Democrat side of the reshuffle, actually, generally speaking, it's gone down pretty well. David Laws...
Just talk us through that, because I think most readers, even, dare I say, most presenters may not be fully up on the Lib Dem shuffle of this week's been overshadowed.
I mean, David Laws' return to government, obviously that's the big headline news. But when you look beyond that at the other changes, the big promotion for Jo Swinson, clearly one of the party's biggest rising stars now.
And she's going to be where?
So she's going to now be in Biz, taking over Norman Lamb's job, where Norman Lamb moving to health. And with a lot of these moves, not only are the new people doing well right in the mainstream of the party, but also a lot of people have been slotted into jobs that fit areas they used to shadow. So Jeremy Brown now in the Home Office, used to be a Home Office spokesperson in opposition. Lynn Featherston in DFID, used to be an International Development spokesperson in opposition. So there's a lot of logic to people being slotted into the right places. I think the thing that generally has been missed, actually, is that overall there is one more Liberal Democrat minister than before, which I think is a surprisingly good part of the reshuffle. The party seems to have kept rather quiet about that, perhaps because it didn't want to provoke Conservatives into outrage at a last-minute change in the reshuffle plans. But the net increase of one in the number of Liberal Democrat ministers is a nice little bonus when you add up all the numbers at the end of the day.
Silver lining for the specialists, Dan, but as a kind of media man, if I can characterise you as that, in the unlikely event you got the call for Lib Dem Towers saying, what are we going to do? Coalition 2.0 is build airports, rip up the Human Rights Act, build prisons and put Jeremy Hunt in charge of the health service. How do we spin this one?
Well, let me take that in two parts, if I may. I was on Sky News, for good or ill, reviewing the papers that the night of the reshuffle with the esteemed George Pascoe Watson, formerly of The Sun and now obviously a PR consultant. And it was quite interesting. George's relationship, I think, with Number 10 is still pretty good. And he was very eager, and indeed the message that came through was that Number 10 was terribly eager to portray this exactly as you started to talk about, as a move to the right, Cameron's being decisive, you know, he's a man, not a mouse. And this is very much the agenda in our newspaper, in The Independent.
The Mail and FT, isn't it?
Well, also The Mail, hold fire on The Mail. What was interesting, though, was that what we wanted to see was what the right-wing press would do, because that's the message you really want to get through to the Tory voters. And actually, The Telegraph in particular getting seduced by the Boris versus Dave narrative and talked about the battle over the third runway. The Mail, as you say, though, did go for it and did sort of feel, I don't know, I think the move of Ken Clark and these sort of changes, I think, have sort of pleased some bits of the right-wing press who are, frankly, the Mail and the Telegraph relations with Number 10 are very poor at the moment. And the great irony is those are papers who are desperate for a particular outcome on Leveson from the Prime Minister and yet, on the other hand, seem to be quite happy to sort of beat Number 10 and beat Cameron over the head on other matters. So I think that's quite an interesting dynamic, and I think it's sort of, I'm not surprised that from a Guardian point of view, and a lot of Liberal readers and watchers would be sort of concerned about the reshuffle, but I'm not surprised perhaps that the right are seeing it differently, because I think the right are not fully paid up lovers of David Cameron. Some are, some aren't.
I'd be interested to know what Mark thinks about this, but one point that some Lib Dems were making strongly to me yesterday was that it doesn't really matter if David Cameron has shuffled his cabinet and his ministerial team to the right, because they have a coalition agreement. If you look at the environment, they also have obviously legislation on targets for climate change, which dictates a lot of the policy you have to pursue as a result. It was much more about signalling to his own party and an internal issue. It was about, as Dan suggests, the right-wing press, the Tory grassroots, the party itself in Parliament, which is very fractious and full of energy and not a lot of contentment. And there are a lot of people very, very worried about their seats. A lot of people, I think, who doubt the majority at the next election, and a growing number of people who I think are actually very unhappy with David Cameron's leadership. I mean, nothing like a majority, but still a worryingly large minority for him, I would say. So I don't know if Mark agrees with that, but I thought it was an interesting take on it when we were so concerned about this right-wing swing, whether it'll actually have much impact on policy or not.
I mean, it's certainly true that the change of personalities in a reshuffle almost always seems far more important at the time than it does when you look at what the government then does a few months down the road. And I think you're absolutely right that whether we see any shift in policies matters far more. I think there is also a slightly paradoxical position that Lib Dems are in, which is that I think generally the Liberal Democrats in government feel David Cameron is someone they can do business with in the terms of disagreeing with him very often, but negotiating, coming up with agreements, etc. What we saw on House of Lords reform, though, was Cameron unable to make that agreement stick with his own party. And so for the Lib Dems, although a bit of a move to the right by the Tories is not instinctively good news, actually, if it ends up with Cameron is more in control of his party, it may be that it makes
so
the coalition
reasonable.
Work better.
These Liberal Democrats, they're so reasonable. I know I'm getting more excited here than anyone else, but it is personality, OK, but isn't the thing that looked different about the offer of this government in the spring of 2010 compared to the Tory governments we remember from the 1980s and 1990s, is, OK, you had a very conservative economic policy that the great Liberal Keynes might not have liked, but on other things from the environment, you weren't going to build an airport. Prisons, you were going to try and reduce the number of people in prison instead of increase them, which is what the new Justice Secretary said he wanted to do just before the last election. On public services, you wanted devolved responsibility. You wanted a new politics. The one man who delivered that, another likeable Liberal Tory, Sir George Young, he's got given the elbow to make way for Andrew Lansley. I mean, what after the House of Lords reform has bitten the dust, what's left? Is it just the tax allowance now and the pupil premium? Is that going to be the rallying cry for the next election?
Well, I think there are a lot of other policy issues, and in perhaps the first one that we'll see the real crunch on is what happens with the draft communications data bill.
The snoopers charter.
Exactly, the online snoopers charter. The pre-legislative scrutiny committee is due to report on that in the fairly near future, and it's really hard to see how, whatever reforms they suggest to the legislation, that they would be sufficient to make Liberal Democrats happy with it. So whether we see that legislation killed or not, big test, I think, for Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats in government. Also, it's a test for whether that sort of slightly more modern, relaxed, liberal, leaving behind Labour's Big Brother approach outlook that was jointly across Lib Dem and Tory in the heydays of the, you know, Rose Garden, immediate formation of the coalition, whether any of that still survives. We'll also see that. But the thing that puzzles me in a way is I just don't understand what the Conservative Party's strategy is now, because as you rightly say, that modernisation programme is very much on its last legs, and it's clearly not the direction the Tory party is headed in. Leaving modernisation behind, giving up on parliamentary constituency boundary changes, I am baffled, even when I listen closely to Tory right-wingers, as to what their strategy is for winning a majority at the next election.
I suppose the point is, Dan, that there's a lot of people who... There's a lot more people who don't read The Guardian and do read The Daily Mail, which, as you say, saluted this as a little shuffle to the right, who might rather like to see Chris Grayling there, who said, you know, we want to push prison population to a record high just before the last election, rather than what... kind of thing that Ken Clark's been saying.
That I think that's the most obvious bit of tonality you've got from that in terms of sort of cheering up the right, you know, moving Ken Clark, although of course Ken Clark's quite popular with the country at large, and so they made up a job for him to carry on. The Mirror sort of, you know, clearly no friend of the Conservatives, but the Mirror sort of, I thought, had the point bang on. The only change that I think the public would have noticed or wanted was the removal of George Osborne, and that was the thing they were never ever going to get. And I think you mentioned Jeremy Hunt earlier, and I'm astounded in a way, the difference between Cameron and Blair, the loyalty that Cameron seems to show to individuals is, I mean, in one sense commendable, but if you want to sort of refresh your look, which is, I think, you know, seemed to be what Tony Blair was doing, or seemed to be sort of getting rid... I mean, people seem to be moving, you know, the whirly gig worked pretty fast, with the exception of Gordon Brown, then you've got to do something a bit more than what he did. And I think it feels astonishing in the case of Jeremy Hunt, having watched him get in the most tremendous tangle, a minister for Murdoch, if you will, over the beast Sky B bid, for him to be rewarded of all things with probably the most complex and difficult ministry and policy terms right now, health.
Yes, I mean, the Dan's point about loyalty is interesting, but it's a question of whether it's loyalty or weakness, really, I think, as well. I mean, I gather Andrew Lansley was slightly surprised and somewhat relieved to still have a post in Cabinet at all. But the Cabinet's got bigger. I mean, we've now got, I think, 31/32 people sitting around the Cabinet room on a weekly basis. I mean, this is enormous. I mean, this is the party of small government, supposedly. They want to slash Whitehall. I mean, what are they going to do when they slash all these departments? Who are they going to give jobs to, you know? They're going to have massive boundary reform, or they're going to have, you know, 90% of their party, you know, out of government. It's just not going to be tenable, really. The other thing I think is interesting, I mean, just going back to my point about the limitations on what they can do, and particularly Chris Grayling, and the fact that this was probably the most significant movement in the Cabinet. The other thing that's going to greatly constrain them is not just the coalition agreement, but the lack of money. I mean, somebody made a very good point the day before the reshuffle, that on one hand, George Osborne must love Ken Clark being in justice. I mean, you know, he can't afford to build more prisons. You know, he can't afford to put people in prison. Community service is great if you're trying to... So if austerity is one of the great right-wing messages, and then they promptly want to go and spend money locking people up, it's going to be very difficult to find the money to do that. And I just wonder how much Chris Grayling is going to have to be used for sort of tone and approach and sort of playing to the sort of grassroots instincts on these things, but won't actually be able to make a lot of difference. I don't know, but where they'll find the money from, I have no idea.
I mean, you have the sense, don't you, that on a number of these things now, as we enter the second half of the government, whether it's the Human Rights Act, Grayling's previously said he wants to tear it up, and on prisons, you know, he'd like to build more, but there's no money just yet. And Heathrow as well, effectively Nick Clegg confirming, Mark, this morning that, yes, the Conservatives might say they'd like to build it in their next manifesto, but they won't be saying it in this term. You're seeing parties just already start to set out completely different shop windows for the election.
Absolutely. I think partly because people are already beginning to look to the next general election and general election manifestos. And also, as Juliet was saying, the money isn't there. I think at the beginning of this parliament, people were expecting that second half of the parliament, economic growth, more tax revenues coming in, there'd begin to be a bit of money to spend on projects. And actually, if you dig out one of the posts I wrote after the 2010 election, it's been horribly overtaken by events, because I was saying, actually, the real trouble for the government would be in the second half of the parliament, when with more money to spend, there'd be real arguments as to whether that should go on tax cuts or more money into public services. That that's clearly not going to be the big argument in the second half of this parliament. But people are beginning to therefore push that argument into the general election manifesto sort of terms, and this question about, you know, do you see Tories pushing really hard for tax cuts? There isn't the money to do it now, but they can be arguing for that in their manifesto.
And you, like, correspondingly putting tax rises on the agenda in terms of wealth taxes. I'm not quite sure how far Nick Clegg's going to push that, but clearly the party wants to push it. What do you think of Labour looking to hug the Liberal Democrats a little bit closer this morning by saying that they're interested in wealth taxes now, and they think that the Labour front bench should be meeting with Vince Cable to discuss them?
Yeah, well, it's a shame they didn't like wealth taxes when they had that, you know, things like having the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Prime Minister and a majority in Parliament and the ability to introduce them. But, you know, nothing like a sinner who repents and all that. And in a way, the more that different political parties are actually trying to work out the details of wealth taxes, the better, because it is one of those issues where the headlines sound so good and the detail is so fearsomely complicated. I mean, people with very long memories will remember how in the 1970s, Labour's attempt to introduce wealth taxes all fell apart because they just couldn't get the details to work. So, you know, if Labour come up with some great ideas and get some of those details working, then brilliant. You know, more ideas for everyone to pull from.
Dan, let's just focus in a little bit then on Jeremy Hunt. You're the scholar. First of all, can we assume David Cameron knows that Jeremy Hunt is in the clear in the Leveson report? There's not going to be some great damnation of him.
I'm pretty sure we can't assume that. And I think David Cameron is rather confident in his position. There's a sort of game here, which is in public inquiries, you get sent, if you're going to be criticised, you get sent a thing, a Rule 13 letter.
And will Jeremy Hunt have had that already?
Well, probably not. The fact that he's not got one at this point is a little bit early, because Lord Leveson's report doesn't come till November, and I think a Rule 13 letter is still possible. This is a formality in one sense, because it's basically the inquiry judge says, I might criticise you, here are the grounds I might criticise you on, this is your last chance, your last right of reply. So it's all perfectly, it's a proper thing to do. But of course, word gets out. They're supposed to say secret, and word gets out. And, separately, all the newspapers have been sent as a 116-page one, and I'm not allowed to talk about that either, but I can tell you The Guardian has got one, and other papers too. So that's the first question, and I think it's too soon to know the answer. And I think it's too soon to know the answer of sort of what the right answer is, you know, what the judge's final verdict will be. And, of course, you know, a phrase or a nuance can make all the difference here. Yes, Jeremy Hunt acquitted himself fairly well in the sense that he sort of withstood 6 hours of questioning in front of the inquiry a few months ago. But he was also sort of really sort of battered by kind of two sets of facts. One, before he got the job of handling the sort of Murdoch bid, he was, you know, seemingly acting as a cheerleader from the sidelines, sort of telling the Prime Minister how great it was, you know, was having sort of covert phone calls with James Murdoch that it wasn't clear whether his perm sec knew about them. And again, sort of, you know, James Murdoch might get terribly angry if we turn this bid down, seemed to be in awe of the man or enthralled to the man, behaved more, a bit more correctly and a bit more discreetly while the bid was going on. But I think it still remains a sort of a question, which is his trusted special advisor, Adam Smith, a guy he's very much liked and still very much likes, you can tell when he's asked about him. Why did he have to get the heave-ho for even when he was acting as an agreed conduit with James Murdoch, sort of special advisor? So, you know, there's a lot that doesn't feel absolutely right, even if, unsurprisingly, you can't find a bit of paper in which there's conspiracy agreed between all parties, because life's not like that.
But the bottom line is, we still don't know, and we don't think that they know either, whether Brian Leveson is going, in the end, to say something pretty damning about Jeremy Hunt, which will now look very bad for Cameron if he does, right?
We don't know, and as I say, I don't think Jeremy's in the clear on what happened. So, look, there is a chance, definitely a chance, of a critical verdict from the inquiry judge come November, and Jeremy Hunt, you know, being in desperate trouble all over again.
Now, if he gets through that, Juliet, the next challenge for the health secretary, after we know Andrew Lansley, the kind of mad professor, if you like, in the eyes of the world, who'd got the great plan that he didn't convince everyone of. The BMA, the Royal College of Nursing, all these very trusted institutions tend to assume the NHS plans aren't about patients, they're a cover for corporate takeover. Isn't David Cameron writing the speeches for all of those groups who want to say, you know, here's a government that hugs corporate power too close by appointing Jeremy Hunt?
They are. I mean, obviously, I presume one of the theories behind appointing a fresh face was that you can make a fresh start with getting to know these groups again, with establishing relationships with them, sort of, you know, ground zero. We've got these reforms, but we can work together on how they're implemented and that kind of thing. But I think that's counterbalanced by the fact that actually even most of Andrew Lansley's worst critics didn't seem to doubt his sincerity in liking the NHS and certainly the ideals of public health and a public health service and wanting to somehow do right. They obviously disagreed with his kind of prescription for it. So I think that you've got a man in Jeremy Hunt who very quickly people were trying to portray as someone who doesn't really love the NHS at all. You know, there were references to all sorts of books he's sort of associated with. He didn't exactly write the words, but he's signed up to or co-authored books which had talked about sort of denationalising the NHS and breaking it up and that kind of thing. I think that's going to make it quite difficult for him. I mean, the general impression is that what Jeremy Hunt is being asked to do is make sure that the health service is not a story. And I can't understand how one man sitting in an office in Whitehall can do something like that when the NHS is thousands and thousands and thousands of small hospitals, GP practices, you know, specialist services all around the country who have millions of patients. You know, the stories will out. And the unfortunate thing for him is he's got the reorganisation, he's got effective budget cuts coming in, cuts in money, and he's got the issue of the private sector taking over services. And some or all of those are bound to cause problems. Even if the whole thing is conceptually brilliant, there are bound to be problems in implementing such a massive, massive change in such a kind of decentralised organisation, full of people at the very most vulnerable moments in their lives. I mean, there are bound to be problems. And how Jeremy Hunt, who doesn't seem to be, I don't think, particularly adept at handling the media anyway, how he's going to somehow keep a lid on this, even if he was brilliant, I just don't understand.
There's also decisions coming up. The legislation's through, but there's an awful lot. It was so covered in fudge by the end, Dan. You know, there's a lot to be settled by regulation and negotiation between the Department of Health and the regulator and so on. From what you know about how Jeremy Hunt approached not just News International but the regulation of the sector of communications in general, do you think we can expect him to push commercialisation quite hard? Would that be his instinct?
Yeah, I think so. First thing about Jeremy is, look, he come initially, there's a sort of initial wave of goodwill around him. He comes over as sort of quite emollient and personable and centrist. However, once you sort of, I think a lot of people from sort of sports, arts and media all felt the same thing, which is that sort of over time they realised actually, you know, he is quite right wing, very sort of deeply conservative, if you will. And a lot of people felt quite let down by him. I mean, the arts sector, he sort of just sort of, when arts funding was sort of for the chop, it was just like, you know, all right, you know, how high can we jump in terms of the cuts and let's get on with it. So they felt he didn't really bat for them very strongly. I think, again, media, and initially a sort of reasonably smart frozen licence fee deal with the BBC was sort of followed by the slowness, you know, the eagerness to placate the Murdochs and the slowness to grip the importance of phone hacking and therefore its impact on the Sky B bid. And yeah, okay, that was a successful Olympics. I mean, it sounds like I'm dismissing it, but it's not Jeremy Hunt's Olympics. I think there are a lot of people who can claim credit for a successful Olympics, and I think Jeremy Hunt is sort of, you know, way, way, way down that list. So, you know, my instinct would be he'll start quite brightly, and I think people will sort of, it'll be a sort of refreshing tonal change, but I think sort of, you know, his political instincts will be pretty sort of right wing and pretty towards sort of commercialisation. And I think over time, people will sort of really register that.
Mark, is he someone you would trust to put the patient first and never to be cutting kind of backroom corporate deals, which is a suspicion that a lot of the medical profession have with this stuff?
Well, I think it was quite interesting that the Lib Dem part of the health reshuffle saw Paul Burstow leave government and Norman Lamb moved over into health, because Norman has not only a lot of background in the health area, but a very strong track record at winning over people to policies that were initially quite controversial. He did that really successfully with post offices and the Royal Mail, with the Liberal Democrats in opposition, and then actually implementing the policy in his first ministerial posting in government. And I think it's no coincidence that he's been put there, because I think one of the things that is a little bit different with the health service from, say, the arts arena is people in arts saying they don't like the government doesn't bring that much political cost. Health professionals saying they really dislike ministers, that brings a huge political cost. Mm. And I think the judgment both Clegg and Cameron has made is to try to get those health professionals back in their traditional role of saying, whatever we think of the policy, we're going to work really hard to try and make the best of it. They needed new people in there because the personal relationships had just got so bad that they were no longer willing to do that.
Norman Lamb might know the area Paul Burstow might not have done, but probably most doctors didn't know who Paul Burstow were and won't know who Norman Lamb is either.
You're being a little unfair there, because actually this is one of the areas where a lot of, you know, the classic case where if what you do in your job is directly affected by what a team of ministers do, actually people often are really quite knowledgeable about ministers, far more so than you might expect.
So you think there is a chance to turn it round with the team of Hunt and Lamb?
I think definitely, and I think their key objective really has to be to get people like the Royal College of Nursing happy enough with what is happening that what the RCN is talking about is how to make the reforms work as best as possible, rather than getting back into the slanging matches over whether the reforms should be happening at all or not.
Well, time will tell. Dan, final question on the sort of media area. Maria Miller, the new face brought in. Do we know anything about her?
No. We really don't. I mean, people say nice things about her, but of course, Adam Hills, who's the sort of disabled Channel 4 comic presenting The Last Leg, I think described her charitably, I think it was a joke, as the Minister for Mutants not that long ago. So I'm sure before any all the millions of listeners come in to criticise me, I'll repeat that somebody else's joke. So that's a memorable line. Look, she's. I've done my research on Google, like the rest of us, in 48, mother of three, and people I know who know her... People I know and know say she's incredibly hard, you know, incredibly hardworking, made a lot of personal sacrifices to get to where she is, and quite dedicated. And I know she works, got a background in PR and marketing, and, you know, I know Labour people who worked at the PR firm she worked in 10, 15 years ago and said nice things about her, and they had no incentive to do so. It's a department that desperately needs a new personality, so good luck to her.
I have to say, she's not somebody that people know a lot about, and therefore there isn't a lot of material out there that's easy to grasp, but... One of the interesting things about her is she makes quite a lot of play in her own profiles of herself about the importance, the central importance to her of being a working mother and how that's central to her politics. But I think that in an era when people are very concerned about the lack of representation of women in government, when we counted up sort of just before the final appointments last night, we were at approximately 1 in 6 ministers being women. David Cameron wants that to be 1 in 3 in just 2 and a bit years' time. I mean, it's impossible to see how he can get there. There are a lot of good women he didn't promote, he could have promoted. I mean, I realise there are a lot of good men as well. But so I think that is interesting. And I think that from that point of view, it's not just about having women. It's about having women who care about the issues for whom it is important to their politics. I think some of the women who've been promoted, it probably won't be that important to their politics, and whether they'll make any difference or not, I don't know. Obviously, they bring talents and skills. That's not to say they shouldn't be in government. But I think it might be quite interesting to have a voice around the cabinet of somebody who, if not calling herself a feminist, at least has some key feminist issues central to her politics. I think that's quite an interesting mix, part of the mix.
Well, finally, let's just turn to the environment. Here's what Boris Johnson thought of Justine Greening being ousted as Transport Secretary.
You know, there's lots of stuff been coming out of the Oracle of Whitehall in the last few months to suggest that a U-turn is in progress and that they want to build a third runway at Heathrow. All the pressure from businesses to do the third runway, that's where the Treasury seems to be focusing its hopes. I think that is a profound mistake.
So it does look, Julia, and you know, there's a new cross-party review going on, that this is back on the agenda very firmly, whether for the next manifesto rather than for this week.
Yes, it sounds like it is. I think that there are few people who don't think that the sort of major push in the Conservative Party is to build another runway at Heathrow. Whether David Cameron and sort of other forces of modernisation are persuaded yet, I don't know. I think when you look at the appointment of the chair of that commission, it's quite hard to conceive how it will come up with any other conclusion than that we should expand Heathrow. I think that's going to cause them some problems. It will obviously win them a lot of support in other areas as
business.
Well. Business, but also, you know, there's a large part of the party that really wants this. You can still argue that aviation is a very, very small proportion of climate change. So if you live in Gloucestershire and you care deeply about climate change, it may not swing your vote. I think one of the things that we need to do as well is to completely dissociate this from any kind of growth agenda in this parliament, though, because this runway will not be built for decades, probably. You know, I mean, let's face it, we've got a review and they can't even suggest they're going to build it till the next election and the next parliament. And they may well not get a majority.
They may well not. Mark, the thing is, it's totemic, isn't it? If you take an environment secretary who's, you know, said to be, fairly or not, a bit of a climate change sceptic and certainly kind of fairly gung-ho on things like airports, and then this totemic issue of airports, it doesn't look great for the environment, does it?
Not necessarily. I mean, interestingly, the reaction of quite a lot of Liberal Democrats in South West London was, I think, has been relatively positive, because what we've seen is a big push from the Tory party to try to get Heathrow built, and the outcome is nothing's going to happen still, is nothing is going to happen in this parliament. And all issues, you know, are up for grabs again at future manifestos and future general elections. So this parliament line has been held. And frankly, if the Tory party, you know, go into the next election trying to argue for building Heathrow, that is going to make the jobs of Liberal Democrat campaigners in marginal South West London seats a heck of a lot easier. So, and, you know, more Liberal Democrat MPs there are, stronger negotiating position there is over Heathrow in future parliaments. So I think when you have a reshuffle, and that involves Tories reshuffling, of course you're going to get Tory people put into place, and that's going to involve putting into place people who have got policies that are Tory policies, not Liberal Democrat policies. But in terms of what the government will actually do different between now and the next election on the environment, so far the news this week has been pretty much neutral. Obviously it may turn out differently. It may turn out actually that the heightened rhetoric and tension over this actually pushes Cameron back towards his old environmentalist green person of 2009-2010. Maybe it won't, but that's very much an open question at the moment.
Very quickly.
Just one small point to make, which is that with Justin Greening in transport, it would have been very difficult for Cameron to come up with a conclusion that we should not expand Heathrow as well. So I think she had to go either way.
OK, well, that's all for this week. You can read all the reshuffle that your corneas can cope with on guardian.co.uk/politics. Our thanks to Juliet Jarrett, to Mark Pack and to Dan Sabber. The producer of the podcast was Ian Chambers. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back again in a week or two.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.